It was about 2.5 hours ago as I was reviewing my subject for today. I had this nagging feeling, and I figured I'd better go back to my list of subjects that I'd given you before. And I didn't see it when I checked it previously, but what do you know? My subject for today was something that I gave to you last May. You might remember the one about Psalm 16, which I was going to elaborate on a little more fully, but being that soon, I thought, well, maybe that's not the subject to cover, so today we're going to see how I do it being impromptu speaker. Actually not. I have quite an archive of materials that I've given over the years, so I went back to some archive material and subjects I've given elsewhere, but I don't think I've given here. Have I done Mithras or the myths of Mithras or Marcion? Have I ever covered that here? Is anyone familiar with those names and who they are, who those individuals are? The churches of this world don't talk about those particular individuals very much, or that particular cult very much, for a reason that will be obvious, I think, as we get further into this. It shouldn't be a surprise to learn, and we know this, but it shouldn't be a surprise to learn that modern religion is built on a base of falsehood. We're not as uncomfortable with that statement as perhaps your Protestant friends would be. But modern religion as we know it has borrowed a lot of ideas, a lot of concepts, and even a lot of practices from non-biblical sources. There are many customs, and there are many practices that you can see in what is called Christianity that did not ever come out of the Bible, though they do their best to make it seem that way. But these two particular names, that of Mithras and that of Marcion, aren't talked about that all that much because it's sort of embarrassing to realize how those people or how that cult worked its way into apostate Christianity back in the 3rd and 4th centuries. If the average worshiper were to find the true origins of many of his cherished beliefs and practices, he would be astounded. Now, this isn't new to most of us, but it would be to many of your friends in the Protestant world, or for that matter, especially the Catholic world, because they certainly are in on this too. Now, they love to talk about their church fathers, Augustine and Justin and this and that and the other, and even Dante, with his graphic illustration that he used to enhance another one of the church's false concepts. But they don't like to talk about these others. And you'll see why. But the cult of Mithras, and if you look it up on the internet, you will find a lot of information on this subject. It is not something that is obscure are not well known or not well documented, but the cult of Mithras began to flourish in the Roman Empire in about the late 1st and early 2nd century AD. Mithras was a god that had come from the Persian area, and it's interesting that the area where this idea came from is the area that bordered where the 10 tribes had for a time gone in the 7th and 8th centuries B.C. But the cult of Mithras found its way into Roman society and became very popular in like the 3rd and 4th centuries. Mithras was regarded as the god of heavenly light. He was regarded as all-seeing. He was regarded as the guardian of oaths, and maybe we could consider the word covenants instead of the word oaths, not that dissimilar. He was the protector of the righteous in this world and in the next. He was the arch foe of the powers of evil and darkness, the god of battles. In Persia, where he was the messenger of Ahura Mazda, god of light, he appeared in the sky at dawn and then crossed the firmament in a chariot drawn by 4 white horses. The sky has always been considered the right place for the supreme beings. And you see that even in Egyptian religion. He served as a mediator between the worlds of light and darkness, as humanity's ally in the struggle against evil, and as the soul's guide in its ascent to the eternal life. Mithras was soon identified as the Redeemer, prophesied by ancient Persian prophets, and also the sun god, who would have appeared as a human being at the end of time. He finally became the supreme godhead and started his triumphal progress across the Greco-Roman world. So by the time the Mithraic cult developed into its final form, it began to be very popular in the Roman and Greek world. Mithras is said to be waiting in heaven for the end of time when he will descend to earth. According to the legend, the Redeemer will be born of a virgin, a goddess. A goddess. His birth will be watched by the shepherds who will worship the newly born. Does this sound familiar at all? These are ancient ideas. Can you see how they could have become blended into the Christian church as it was becoming apostate? His earthly mission culminates with his victory over the bull. And that may not have a lot of significance to us, but when we realize that once this bull was slain, out of this bull grew corn to make bread and grapes to make wine. From the body of the dying bull grow corn and grapes until Mithras finally mounts to heaven in the sun chariot and is enthroned by the God of Light as the ruler of the world, who would return to earth to awaken the dead and pass judgment. Do you see parallels again? The legend does not specify whether his birth is a past or future event. But these are some of the basic ideas that began to infiltrate into Roman culture and society and Greek culture and society prior to the rise of Christianity above a persecuted cult. For those who believed in Mithras, he was the coming one whose arrival was celebrated every year on the night of, guess what night? December 24th and 5th. Does that ring a bell at all? When the community had its important festivity, a pre-existing important festivity was observed on the night of 24-25 December. Another big annual festival by the Mithraic cult was held at the start of spring, about the time that we would see Easter being observed. Their weekly divine service was held on, guess which day of the week? On Sunday, the day of the Supreme Being. So at the time when the early New Testament church was going through the throes of rejecting the Sabbath and accepting another day, the idea of holding a religious worship service on Sunday was already ancient. It was the mainstay of the Mithraic cult. And you can check this out. It's in history. It's a well-known fact. That ought to ring alarm bells, but it seems that it doesn't. The most important cult activity was a meal of wine and bread. Remember that bowl? Offered as consecrated wafers bearing the sign of a cross. The institution of a state cult, the cult of Sol Invictus, the unconquerable sun in Rome, was made by Aurelian. Now remember, this is prior to the time of Constantine, but was declared by Aurelian in about 270 to 275 AD. And it may have contributed to the prestige of Mithra, who also bore this proud title, Sol Invictus. But Mithra has never achieved a place in the public cults of the state. It was the year 307 AD under Diocletian. An imperial dedication was made to Sol Invictus Mithra, acclaiming him as the protector of the empire. Constantine came to power in 306. So at least a quarter century earlier, Aurelian had already declared for the religion of Sol Invictus, the sun god, who was worshipped on Sunday, at least a quarter century before the time of Constantine. So Mithraic worship was already established in Rome prior to the time of Constantine. We're told the myth that Constantine accepted Christianity and made it legal in the Roman world when, in fact, he was simply adapting something that had already been accepted and declared a state religion a quarter of a century before. Now that gives rise to the consideration of how pure was so-called Christianity by the time of Constantine. And as we can see, when Constantine convened the First Council of Nicaea, I'm sorry. We can see by that time that many of the important characteristics of Christianity were already being degraded and rejected and expelled from the church. For example, keeping the Passover. You can look up the Quarto Deciman controversy. It wasn't a question about which day of the week the Passover should be on. It was a question of whether we ought to reject Passover in lieu of Easter. This was in the time of Constantine. The Sabbath, similarly, was being rejected. So we can see by the time of Constantine, basic fundamental Christianity, the faith once delivered, was already being heavily degraded. So was it Christianity that Constantine embraced, or was it a pre-existing state religion that was gradually coming to blend with and be called Christianity? Important difference. Now, we're also told that the early Christians met in catacombs, these caves in the earth where they had to hide out and have their services in secret. If you look up Mithraism, you will find out that the Mithraic cult sought out and favored caves for holding their services. Their services were very secret. Much of what was done there was not well publicized. It was known to the adherents, but it wasn't put down in any kind of written document that we have record of. Much of what we know about Mithraic cult is written by detractors, which was preserved. But the Mithraic service itself was not well preserved. But it was the Mithraics, the cult of Mithras, who originally, at least, met in caves and catacombs. And they even got to the point where in larger cities, they built a cave under the ground where there wasn't one, so that they could hold their services in these underground caves. There was a recent National Geographic magazine, I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me, but that showed one of these. It was wonderfully built. Nice arches and vaults and all kinds of things. Typical of many ancient churches, but it was entirely underground, and it still exists. And the mosaics in it, they're beautiful. But this was the Mithraic tradition, to meet in caves under the ground. Come to find out, the Vatican is built right over one of these, one of the primary ones in the city of Rome. We're told that it was built over a Christian catacomb. But it was Mithraism being called Christianity. This site had been used long before the time of Constantine as a Mithraic cult location. And that's true of many of the churches in the ancient world, that they were built on top of pre-existing sites. Christianity and Mithraism have much in common. For example, it has a divine Lord by whose deeds, performed once, man was assured of salvation. In the case of Mithras, it was the slaying of the bull. But that was the divine sacrifice which apparently absolved the Mithraic worshiper. Whereas in Christianity, there's a slightly different version, but there's certain similarities too. It had a sacramental meal. It had a ritual of baptism. And I'm going to guess it wasn't immersion, but they still call it baptism. It had a concept of religion which turns the religious life to enlistment and service under a divine commander like Militia Christi or Militia Mithrae. Their ideas of heaven and hell and of the last judgment were not all that dissimilar. And I would say not all that dissimilar to what is called modern Christianity, the ideas of heaven and hell. Our views are slightly different, but consider Protestant or Catholic views on heaven and hell. Their ideas on that were not that dissimilar. The Mithraic cult had a moral code considerably higher and more rigid than that found in a contemporary society or what was required by most other cults. The Mithraic cult had a high moral standard. They weren't necessarily wild pagans as we would consider them. We would see them as quite respectable, except for some of their obvious beliefs. The spiritual leader of the hierarchical organized Mithras religion was entitled Pater Patrum, the Father of Fathers, like the Roman Pope. But I want to call attention to this particular line. The spiritual leader of the hierarchically organized Mithras religion. The Mithras religion was highly organized and structured, and that'll be important when we come to the next fellow we look at. The Pope's Church, the Church of St. Peter, was built over a Mithraic cult site. This is not a secret, although they may call it something else. The Mithras cult had six other sacraments which corresponded completely with those of the Catholic Church, including a slap during confirmation. So when in the 4th century, or the beginning of the 4th century AD, Emperor Constantine declared the Catholic Christianity as the state religion, he had no alternative but to take over the liturgy of the popular Mithraic Church. It was the religion of his empire by that time. It was already popular. If he tried to impose something that wasn't popular already, can you imagine what would have happened? It was more a name change than anything else. And in that manner, the Mithraic cult blended into what is called Christianity, and to this day preserves many of its practices and doctrinal errors. It's something we ought to be aware of, because that's what we're dealing with in the modern world. The remnant of that, or the ramifications, or the development of that as it has worked out through history. Many of these things have origins in the religion of Mithras. But like I say, it's something you can go on online and do a study with, and you'll see that there's tremendous amounts of information, far more than I'm presenting to you here. I'm just hitting some of the highlights. Some of the more obvious things. For those who believed in Mithras, he was the coming one whose arrival was celebrated every year on the 9th of December 25th, when the community had its important festivity. This is the day of the winter solstice, or at least it was back at that time, adopted by the early Christians as the birthday of Jesus. Another big annual festival was held on the start of the spring. We call it Easter. The weekly divine service was held on Sunday, the day of the Supreme Being. So it shouldn't be any surprise to us that that correlation or that apparent similarity between Mithraism and Christianity is embarrassing to those who embrace modern-day Christianity. So you can see why they don't talk about it all that much. But it's a fact of history, and it's an easily discovered fact of history. So it's something we need to be aware of, that what is called Christianity today has roots in places other than in the Bible. Now there's another fellow that we need to consider, and his name was Marcion. And in the last several times that I've spoken to you, I've sort of touched on this particular consideration. Marcion contributed to Christianity at about the same time. Perhaps he was a little before that time. His interference was somewhat before the time of Constantine. But he added a view that even though Marcion was regarded by the early New Testament church fathers as a heretic, yet we still, to some degree, hold on to one of his basic tenets. And we live in a world that believes like this, or like he did, and I'm not sure we entirely realize it, but perhaps to some degree this idea of his is in our minds as well, and it's something that we need to resolve if we're ever going to understand the true identity and the true office of Jesus Christ. Marcion was a rich shipowner, lived on the southern shores of the Black Sea, and later in life, he went on to become a bishop in what was then the Christian church. And this was long before what we consider the great apostasy, but the church was certainly apostatizing even as late as the early, you know, the early 100s AD. But it seems sometimes that heresy can have a life of its own. That even though the heresy is rejected, it pops up somewhere else in a different form. Like with the Mithraic cult, we don't have a lot written by Marcion himself. What we know about Marcion is largely a result of those who wrote against him. Those writings were preserved, but they regarded Marcion as a serious heretic. And you have to wonder why, if the early church thought he was a serious heretic, why is his idea still present in the modern age? But this Marcion fellow was interesting. Like I say, later in life, he went on to become a bishop. His father had been a bishop. And I saw a documentary on History Channel recently, and they're describing this fellow, and where I cut into the thing, they hadn't mentioned his name, and I'm saying to myself, boy, that sounds exactly like Marcion. And sure enough, it was. But again, this fellow is well known by the Christian world for his heresies and what he did to the so-called Christian church. There was a component in society at the time, and Marcion's idea, I'm not sure, was entirely his own. Marcion may have picked up a pre-existing concept that existed in the world of his day, but he certainly ran with it. And because the idea was popular, he gained popularity in a very short time. His ministry was rather short, but he had thousands of churches throughout the ancient world. That component that was in Marcionic thinking we can find in Romans 8:7, a verse that we often refer to because it conveys the attitude that is so typical of the natural human state. But in Romans 8:7, because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. And this was largely Marcion's problem area. The law of God was somewhat objectionable to him. He worshipped a Jesus, or an idea of Jesus, which was basically anti-law. He represented the God of the Old Testament as being a different being than the God of the New. Does that at all sound familiar? Even though modern religion may disagree with that idea on the face, yet if you look behind the scenes conceptually, it is very much a part of modern so-called Christian theology. The idea that the God of the Old Testament, with this harsh, stern, austere being who imposed his law, and that Jesus came along and did away with all that and was gentle and mild and sweet and didn't require anything of anybody. Does that concept at all sound similar to what you hear in the churches of this world today? Because that was basically Marcion's idea, and I'm saying it wasn't necessarily his that he originated it, but it existed in the early second century, the early first century actually. And he merely picked up on it and made a cult of his own out of it. Marcion's chief activity at Rome may be placed somewhere between the years 150 and 160 AD. At first, he was in communion with the church at Rome and contributed handsomely to its funds. But as the presbyters could not explain his difficulties and refused to face the important questions he set before them, he is said to have threatened to make a schism in the church, and apparently was finally excommunicated. So we had an early church in the 150s AD who did not agree with his idea that the God of the Old Testament was a different being than the God of the New. An important glimpse in there, a very interesting admission by the popular sources. The early New Testament church did not buy that idea. The matter of the fact of the origin of Marcionism is entirely wrapped in obscurity, and we know nothing of a reliable nature of the life of Marcion. Church writers at the end of the second century, who are our best authorities, cannot tell us the story of the beginning of the movement with any certainty, for we all know Marcion may have developed his theories long before he came to Rome. This much we know, that the views of Marcion spread rapidly over the whole world. Why? Because the world was primed for that idea. The whole world was already at enmity, at odds against the law of God, was not subject to them, neither indeed could be. So Marcion appealed to the natural mind. And lo and behold, we see a form of belief put forth by him that has striking similarities to what you see in the Protestant world today. And here's an interesting line. Marcionite churches sprang up splendidly organized with their own bishops and the rest of the ecclesiastical discipline, with a cult and service of the same nature as those of what subsequently became the Catholic Church. Think about that. Marcion did not borrow the form of organization from the pre-existing early New Testament church. He went somewhere else and borrowed a form of organization that had pre-existed. Marcionite churches sprang up splendidly organized with their own bishops and the rest of the ecclesiastical discipline, with a cult and service of the same nature as those of what subsequently became the Catholic Church. Where did Marcion get his organizational format? Very likely from the cult of Mithras, because it was organized very similar. It had its bishops, it's had its this and that, and its cardinals or the equivalent thereof, may have different names, but it was organized, and as we saw back in the Mithraic cult, was hierarchical, with the chief seat being occupied by a person called Pater, father. What then was the secret of Marcion's success? It was the same as that of the success of modern criticism as applied to the problem of the Old Testament. What problem of the Old Testament? Marcion's view was in some respects even more moderate than the judgment of some of our modern thinkers. He was willing to admit that the Yahweh of the Old Testament was just. I mean, he didn't want to call the God of the Old Testament bad in any way. He was at least willing to admit that he was just. And with great acumen, he arranged the sayings and doings ascribed to Yahweh by the writers and the compilers and editors of the heterogeneous books of the Old Testament collection in parallel columns, so as to say, with the sayings of one as compared to the sayings of the other. And he presented a contrast between Old Testament teachings and New Testament teachings. That's basically what that complicated sentence was saying. Have you seen anything like that done lately? Maybe in the WCG about 12 years ago? I did. But the idea that he was presenting was that the God of the Old Testament was a different being in contrast to and with a very different nature than the God of the New, when we know that they're one and the same. And the early New Testament church threw Marcion out on the basis of his allegation. They called that heresy. So it shows you what they believed at that time, that the early New Testament church recognized that the God of the New Testament, the God of the Old, were not in contrast to one another. They were not different beings. They were not at odds with one another. And you couldn't accept one without the other. That was Marcion's heresy. If this wasn't the case, what was the basis of Marcion's protest? Do you see what idea he injected into the thought stream of the early church as it was going apostate? Now, we don't know what became of Marcion's churches. Very likely, they simply blended in time. But Marcion was a major factor in the middle 100s AD. And how that came out, we don't know. But one thing we can see, that in the modern age, we have somewhat of that idea, to some degree. And since we live in this world that's like it is, we perhaps pick up that idea subliminally without realizing it, that the God of the Old Testament had a different nature than the God of the New, when in fact that isn't what changed at all. But when you are antinomian, when your basic nature, like Romans 8:7 says, is against the law of God, when you are that way, then it tends to appear to be like that. Now, another thing that Marcion taught, and this one is going to really sound familiar, but Marcion largely rejected most of the books of the New Testament. He focused on the writings of the Apostle Paul. He was the originator of what we call today Pauline theology. He accepted what Paul wrote, but he largely rejected what the other New Testament writers wrote. Does that sound familiar at all? Marcion's view was in some respects even more moderate than the judgment of some of our modern thinkers. And after making that statement, this source goes in to explain his attitude towards the writings of the New Testament. That he took the writings of the Old Testament and the writings of the New Testament, arranged them in parallel columns to contrast them with one another, so to say, with the sayings and the teachings of Christ, in a series of antitheses which brought out in startling fashion the fact that though the best of the former might be ascribed to the idea of a just God, they were foreign to the ideal of the good God preached by Christ. We know how, in these latter days, the best minds in the church have rejected the sayings and doings ascribed to God in some of the Old Testament documents. And we thus see how Marcion formulated a protest which must have already declared itself in the hearts of thousands of the more enlightened of the Christian name. And what does that mean? The more enlightened of the Christian name. The enlightenment is probably those who drifted toward Gnostic teachings. But as to the actual history, then, Marcion started with Paul. he being the first who had really understood the mission of Christ and had rescued the teaching from too much Jewish influence. Of the manifold versions of the gospel, he would have Pauline teachings alone. He rejected every other recension, including those now ascribed to Matthew, Mark, and John. The gospel according to Luke, the follower of Paul, he also rejected, regarding it as a recension to suit the views of the Judaizing party. Does any of that sound familiar? Judaizers. His gospel was presumably the collection of sayings in use among the Pauline churches of his day. Of course, the patristic writers say that Marcion mutilated Luke's version, but it is almost impossible to believe that if he did this. So keen a critic as Marcion should have retained certain verses which made against strong anti-Judaistic views. The Marcionites, on the contrary, contended that their gospel was written by Paul from the direct tradition and that Luke had nothing to do with it. But this is also a difficulty, for it's highly unlikely that Paul wrote any gospel. So many Orthodox apologists wrote against Marcion after his death that it is possible to reconstruct almost the whole of his gospel. It begins with the public preaching of Christ at Capernaum. It's shorter than the present Luke document, and some writers of great ability have held that it was the original of Luke's version, but this is not very credible. As for the rest of the documents included in the present collection of the New Testament, Marcion would have nothing to do with any of them, except the letters of Paul, parts of which he rejected as interpolations by the reconciliators of the Petro-Pauline controversy. These 10 letters were called the Apostolicon. Marcion's teachings departed from traditional Christianity in a number of ways. Most dramatically, perhaps, Marcion rejected that the Old Testament God and the New Testament God were the same being. Up until that time, the traditional church had considered the Old Testament to be sacred and assumed that Christianity was a fulfillment or a continuation of Judaism. Marcion's rejection of that idea affected many different doctrines and beliefs. And if you think about it, you can see how people's beliefs would be very distinctly warped if you take the position that the Old Testament law is to be stricken from New Testament practice. And that's what Marcion tried to do. And it was popular in his day. It still is. Marcion faced an uphill battle with his revolutionary idea. He faced a pretty obvious problem. For more than 100 years, Christians had been using the Old Testament as scripture. And even the most sacred documents of Christians referred to and relied heavily on the Old Testament. The solution for Marcion was to completely reject the Old Testament and establish a canon that de-emphasized Christianity's Old Testament and Jewish roots as much as possible. So Marcion taught that the God of the Old Testament was not the God of the New Testament. The God of the Old Testament was the creating God, but he was harsh, cruel, and incompetent. Marcion contrasted this creating God with the God of Jesus, who was nothing less than love and grace. Marcion was perhaps the most prominent early heretic that the Church of God ever encountered. The early church writers wrote against Marcion. So why do you find his ideas so thoroughly laced through what is called Christianity today in the modern age? Can you begin to understand why the churches of this world don't like to talk about Marcion, and certainly not about the Mithraic cult? As the above comments show, the early church was accepting of the idea that the God of the Old Testament and the theology therein as being the true faith, though amended with additional fulfilling provisions, such as grace and the indwelling of God's Spirit, allowing practical fulfillment of Hebrews 8:8-10 and Ephesians 2:10. Hebrews 8:8-10 is where it talks about putting God's law in our hearts. The God of the Old Testament, the God of New, we're one and the same. We know that. We believe that. Many of our beliefs are based on that fundamental concept. We have evidence that that's what the early New Testament church believed by the fact of Marcion's protest. If he didn't protest the fact, or if it wasn't the fact, how could he have protested it? So we see that the early New Testament church believed much the same as we do today in that respect, that the God of the Old Testament and God, the God of the New, are one and the same being. The other objection is the applicability of God's law in the Christian religion. It might appear that these two primary objections are not related. That the God of the Old Testament not being the God that Jesus personified, and the rejection of the Old Testament law as the moral code. They are related. In fact, they are very symbiotic. What Marcionites fail to understand, and what the modern counterparts of that same concept fail to comprehend, is the fundamental truth that the being who met with Abraham and the being who gave the law on Mount Sinai was one and the same who became God in the flesh some 2,000 years ago. Let's look at John 8:56. We have time. Let's do a little bit of browsing here. John 8:56. In speaking with the Jews of his day, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. Then said the Jews unto him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? And Jesus gave them an answer that effectively said, yes. Jesus said unto them, verily, verily, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am. Then took they stones to cast at him. But Jesus hid himself. They recognized what he was claiming, that he had pre-existed before the time of Abraham, that he had. That idea is also in question in modern religion. The God who dealt with Israel, who led the physical Israel out of Egypt, is the one and the same who leads spiritual Israel out of our bondage to sin, 1 Corinthians 10:4. Paul recognized this, and why Marcion didn't pick this up, I don't know, but here it is in one of the Pauline writings, 1 Corinthians 10:4. I'll begin in verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you should be ignorant how that all our fathers were under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat the same spiritual meat, and did all drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. Paul believed that the God who dealt with ancient Israel in the Old Testament was one and the same. It was the pre-incarnate Christ who created and renewed the earth at the behest of the Father, John chapter 1, verses 3 and 10. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. If he wasn't the creator on his own, he certainly was the creator at behest of the Father. Over to verse 10. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. This being, the God of the New Testament, was one and the same, who created. It was he who rested, creating the Sabbath day, Hebrews chapter 4. And here's a spot that people tend to overlook. Hebrews chapter 4. verses 4 through 8. For he spoke in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest the seventh day from all his works. The one who rested is who? And in this place again, if they shall enter into my rest. He's making a comparison between the physical rest and a spiritual rest. Seeing therefore it remains that some must enter therein, and they to whom it was first preached enter not because of unbelief. Again, he limits a certain day, saying in David, today, after so long a time, as it is said, today, if you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. For if Jesus had given them rest, then would he not afterward have spoken of another day? The writer of the book of Hebrews is, in effect, alleging that Jesus was the one who created the Sabbath day. In John 5:18, another interesting statement. Because here, Jesus Christ claimed an equality that the Jews of his day took serious exception to. John 5:18. Therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he had not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. They recognize something that perhaps modern religious people don't. That to claim to be the Son of God was making yourself equal. They saw that, and they were picking up stones in response. What he was in effect saying, that the Yahweh Elohim of the Old Testament was one and the same as was Jesus Christ. Hebrews chapter 1. And this may be one of the reasons why people take exception to the book of Hebrews, claiming that it wasn't written by the Apostle Paul, which is another subject another day. But the important statement is contained in here, and we could dismiss it if it weren't for the fact that it's also in the Old Testament. But Hebrews chapter 1, verses 8 through 10. But here we see God the Father speaking to his Son. But unto the Son he says, thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. A scepter of righteousness is the scepter of thy kingdom. God is calling his Son God. Thou hast loved righteousness and hated iniquity. Therefore God, even thy God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness above your fellows. And you, Lord, in the beginning hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the works of thine hands. We read just a few verses ago who that was. So how the early New Testament church warped, we could point out a number of things. The early New Testament church understood that Jesus Christ is God, and we could say God also. He is the God of the Old Testament who dealt with mankind, who gave the law on Mount Sinai. The Church of God has long understood the identity, the true identity of the God of the Old Testament. Luther and the Protestant movement subtly resurrected the basic concepts of Marcionic teaching. That's basically how the ideas that we know today in the Protestant religion were revived back into the religious thought stream. Though rejecting Marcionic theology, yet the apostate church retained its subliminal perceptions. And this is one primary reason why we can't reconcile Protestant theology with New Testament truth. The Church of God that existed in the first century is a very different institution and conveys very different beliefs than what our early New Testament believers held. We today have retained many of those, and perhaps we could do a better job. But it's important to recognize the contamination that came into the church as it went apostate sometime after 100 AD. We need to realize where these things came from. And today I think I gave you the source of many, not all. There are other writers who could be presented in a similar manner. But we need to recognize that the church believes things that are, by this time, rather unique. We need to hold them because, as we saw 10 to 15 years ago, that a whole new cavalry can come galloping through the church and move those ideas right back to the old rut. You know what I'm talking about. So I hope this has been helpful. I hope it's been enlightening. It's something we need to be careful about. It's something that we need to be alert to. It's not a matter of inconsequence. It's important. But the truth of the Bible is very different than the religion of this modern age.